Shall we start? Can I say how pleased I am to see everyone back here? I hope you're having a nice term already. Let me just say a bit about what I'm going to talk about this term. This term I'm going to give four lectures in sequence from this week, each Wednesday. In this lecture, I'm going to talk about the concept of risk and why the idea of risk is now so central in analyzing what's happening to the modern world. In the next lecture, next week, I'm going to talk about the global impact of democracy. And I want to pose the question, what accounts for the world historical success of the idea of democracy in the 20th century? Because we're all Democrats now, but it certainly was not always the case. Until well into this century, most of the population in most countries were not in favor of even the idea of democracy. Something very important to be explained here. In the third lecture, I'll be discussing changes in personal life. And I want to pose the question, why is there, and if so, why is there a crisis of the family? How does this relate to changes in our emotional lives? What possibilities are there for the reconstruction of our personal life in such a way that we can bring our emotions into line with what I would see as the demands of everyday life in modern societies? Is there in some sense a crisis of the emotions in late modernity? The final lecture, I want to come back to the theme of politics and raise the issue of whether there is indeed a new politics around, and try to sketch out, if there is, what its contours may be. And along the way, I'll be trying to answer some of the problems that I had established in the first four lectures last term. The overall theme of these lectures, really, as you know, is the question of what kind of society we are now living in. What kind of future have we built for ourselves? How do we cope with the forces which we have unleashed upon the world? Let me begin by posing some more questions to you. Let me ask you what the following might have in common. First of all, the current crisis in East Asia, which is bound up, as we all know, in some sense with the impact of financial markets, but which has produced very suddenly and sharply a crisis not just for the Asian economies, but perhaps for the world economy as a whole. First example. Second, BSE, so-called mad cow disease. What is it? Where did it come from? What does it store up for us? So far, it's been estimated that the epidemic of BSE has cost the British economy something like £6 billion. But BSE is in no sense a UK problem. It is bound up with what we've done to food production as part of the transformations of the world which we are engineering. Third, red wine. Why should it be that until relatively recently, drinking wine was thought to be bad for us, and now suddenly it seems to be good for us? So that, well, it's a very pleasurable thing, so that if you drink two glasses of red wine a day, it's now reckoned to be a health food rather than it was once thought to be a poison. You can take many other examples, by the way, from food, such as pasta. Why is pasta, which 10 years ago apparently made us fat, now seemingly makes us thin? Next example, more serious one, hit home to some people in this room, by definition, declining sperm counts. Is it the case that perhaps a quarter of the men sitting in this room are infertile? It's actually a very serious issue. Infertile is not the same as potency, by the way. But some, it's a serious issue. A whole range of recent findings on human reproduction suggest the capability of the race to reproduce itself might be seriously under threat. No one knows why, except the suspicion is, if this is true, that it's a result of environmental toxicities, including especially the impact of various kinds of pesticides and their widespread use, polluting the air we breathe, the food we eat, and other aspects of our environment. Finally, a sort of hoary old example, global warming. Global warming's been a long time, much debated. It's the kind of thing you can get sick of. Nevertheless, it is probably a real phenomenon with potentially devastating consequences for the world climate and perhaps also for the global society and global economy. All these are very disparate examples, as I hope you'll agree. And if you ask what they share in common, well, they all share two things in common, I think. First, they are all risk environments. They are all examples of risks which, whether we like it or not, we face. They're all examples, secondly, crucially for this lecture really, of risks that we have created. They're all probably, anyway, examples of risks that we have created as the result of the technical, social, and economic development of our societies. They are not like risks stemming from earthquakes or pre-existing natural phenomena. They are risk environments in which our own activities are very deeply involved. In this lecture, I'll be wanting to ask why the notion of risk is so important now. To see its importance, I suggest that after this lecture, if you, for the next few days, look at the newspapers, watch TV, check on the number of times the term risk comes up. It appears almost everywhere once you're sensitized to it. We are, in a certain sense, as you'll be arguing later on, living in a risk society where the notion of risk has a focal importance for us which it has not had for previous generations, and where the very nature of the risks we face has altered. Now, these themes are directly connected with the very general themes concerning the word I mustn't mention, modernity, from the very first lecture onwards. In that lecture, I defined the world in which we live as a world which has taken us by surprise. The world at the end of the 19th century is not the world which the main intellectual traditions of the social sciences, in which most of us are schooled, prepared us for. A world which has taken us by surprise is a world we must find new ways of confronting. And it is a world which compromises some of the ideals and aspirations of enlightenment. The enlightenment, you remember, had a fairly simple theorem. I mean, the enlightenment was a complex thing, agreed, but in enlightenment culture and in the orientation of modern civilization, there was a simple and very powerful theme which is embedded in all our lives so centrally that we often fail to recognize it. And this is a theme of the liberating or emancipatory consequences of knowledge, the accumulation of knowledge. Whether that knowledge be about the natural world, or whether that knowledge be about culture, ourselves, our own history, our own society. The chief principle of the Enlightenment was the more we get to know about the world, whether it be the social world or the natural world, the more we can control those worlds to human interests, the more we can become the masters of our own history, and the more we can break away from the unenlightened forms of life which people have lived in previous generations. Marx was the thinker, really, who gave this theorem flesh, and in the form of Marxism, it's dominated 19th century and 20th century history. Marx argued that human beings are made by history, that human beings are intrinsically historical, but until recently we have not made our own history. We have not made our own history because we did not understand ourselves and we did not understand the world of nature around us. As we begin through science and technology to understand the natural world, as we begin through the social sciences to understand ourselves, so we can assume control of our own fate. That principle, I suggest, which is the Enlightenment principle, was the chief appeal of Marxism. And many people have seen Marxism as a kind of secular faith, a kind of secular religion, but I don't think that is really true. I think Marxism drew its appeal from the rejection of religion and the idea that we can become the masters of the world, that we can subject the world to human purposes precisely if we break away from the mystifications of the past. Now, the world in which we live at the end of the 20th century is simply not like that. There were many people who anticipated, along with Marx, a humanly controlled world. Some of these people, unlike Marx, produced negative utopias. Negative utopias were the other side of the idea that we can master ourselves and master human society. A typical negative utopia is the kind sketched by George Orwell in 1984 and other writings, by the novelist Franz Kafka, and by the sociologist Max Weber. What they saw was a kind of world of bureaucratic nightmare. They saw a world in which all of us would be small cogs in a gigantic machine. They thought that the progress of human reason would be so intense, so capable, so clear, so complete would be our control over the world, that all humanity would become little cogs in a vast bureaucratic machine. What Marx saw as emancipatory, they therefore saw as dystopia, as a future to be avoided. But neither vision has turned out to be true. We don't live in a world, I think, in which we are increasingly masters of our own fate. It's the fundamental discovery for moderns, for people schooled in modern Western civilization living at the end of the 20th century. In many quite easily specifiable respects, we are not the masters of our fate, and historically we were schooled to expect that we should be, I think. I'll be arguing in a later lecture this applies to our personal lives just as much as to our collective futures. The sense of a dislocated personal future, the sense of a personal life which is out of control, I think is very common now in everyday life. It is a refraction, expression of these wider changes affecting us. We are not cogs in a bureaucratic machine, so the dystopian vision is also wrong, I think. Of course there are bureaucracies. Of course it's true that parts of the world look like that. But on the whole, I think the dominant image of the late 20th century is a world out of control rather than a world within control. All of the examples I quoted at the beginning of the lecture are kind of out of control examples rather than in control examples, which the East Asian crisis would be the first one I mentioned, a very good instance. We live in a world which I described, I think, in the first lecture as a runaway world, a world which seems erratic, which seems fractured, and which is characterized by unpredictabilities. One of the most important of those unpredicted events was the collapse of communism itself, which I discussed last term. Very few, if anybody, projected that this would happen in the way in which it happened. Quickly, overnight, without fuss, without much violence, vanished from history. A quite amazing thing. It is a kind of marker, I think, of the world which I'm seeking to describe in these lectures a world which has taken us by surprise. Now, in order to understand what's happened here, I think one has to understand that what's happened to the Enlightenment is that the accumulation of knowledge does not in and of itself, as the Enlightenment believed, or many Enlightenment thinkers believed, yield greater control, greater predictability. The unpredictabilities which surround us at the end of the 20th century, to repeat, don't by and large come from the externally given world, the world of nature. They come from the world we've created. The image of enlightenment and the image which is so powerful for us today is a little bit more knowledge will allow us to fill in the gaps. The typical attitude of enlightenment is give us more knowledge, because more knowledge will allow us to resolve the problems we face. According to this view, unpredictability stems from ignorance. If the world is unpredictable in key spheres of our lives, it's because we don't know enough about how the world works. But this is not the case. It has not turned out to be the case. Something much more subtle, more intriguing, but fundamental for our lives has turned out to be the case, which is that the unpredictabilities of the world which surround us, all the way through from marriage, the emotions, sexuality, through to global warming, through to global economic systems, all of these don't come from outside ourselves. All of these are the product of knowledge. All of these, in some sense, are bound up with the very accumulation of knowledge and with the very impact of science and technology on our lives. We have to investigate the subtle relationship that exists between the accumulation of knowledge or claims to knowledge and generated unpredictability, created unpredictability. To do so, we need to make a distinction between what I call, on the one hand, external uncertainty or external risk, and manufactured uncertainty or manufactured risk. The terms risk and uncertainty are sometimes separated, especially by economists, a separation which comes from the work of the economist Frank Knight, who argued that risks exist when you can calculate them, uncertainties exist when you can't. For reasons that I don't have time to go into here, I don't think this distinction is a logical one, sustainable one. Therefore, I shan't draw any distinction in this lecture between risk and uncertainty, because a key part of the risks we face now precisely is their uncertainty. By external risk or external uncertainty, I mean uncertainty or risk which derives around the edges of two sets of phenomena. First of all, from nature, from the natural world, from the world as given to us, and second, from the fixities of tradition, culture, and taken for granted customs. I want to argue that until relatively recently, in many spheres of life, nature was still nature and tradition was still tradition. They provided, as it were, landscapes for our activity. And the risks and uncertainties surrounding them came, as it were, from outside human intervention, or were experienced as such. External risk we have to separate from manufactured uncertainty or manufactured risk, by which I mean not deliberately created risk. I mean risks which derive from the very accumulation of knowledge and the impact of science and technology on the world. Manufactured or created risk represents new risk environments which have quite distinctive qualities of the kind I'll try to tease out later in the lecture. I want to propose to you, we are living in a world which is experiencing a shift from the dominance of external uncertainty to the dominance of manufactured uncertainty. It is not the case, I think, that the world is more risky than it used to be. There would be no way to demonstrate this, I think, even if I wanted to make this assertion. It is not the case that the world is more uncertain than it used to be. You only have to think back to life in the Middle Ages to see what a risky business it was. Life was indeed nasty, brutish, and short, in the famous phrase. However, in the Middle Ages, first of all, there was no concept of risk at all. And second, the experience of uncertainty was uncertainty which comes either from God, from the external world, from the action of spirits, or simply from fate, simply from luck, simply from how things are. Our world is different from this. We are trying to come to terms with a world of manufactured uncertainty in which the principles of enlightenment no longer fully apply. We do not, I think, live in a postmodern society. We live in a society, as I've stressed many times and as I was picked up for, shaped by the impact of modernity. However, that society is experiencing the contradictions, the problems, the limitations of both the cultural thrust of modernity, the impact of science and technology on modernity, and other aspects of the systems which modern society has brought into being. Before I pursue the distinction between external and manufactured uncertainty, let me just say a bit about the concept of risk, because it's really, really interesting and resonant for these issues. Life in the Middle Ages was a risky business, but there was no concept of risk, so far as one can trace out. Most traditional cultures have no notion of risk, not an exact translation of our word risk. Why should that be so, given that life then was as risky as it is now, perhaps riskier in many respects, less security in many respects than there is now? Why should this be so? The reason is that you only have a concept of risk in a society which orients itself towards the future. There is a distinction between risk and hazard, or risk and danger. Risk is not the same as hazard. Risk is not the same as danger. Risk refers to dangers or hazards which are confronted in respect of an open future which either an individual or a collectivity seeks to shape. The idea of risk seems to have had its origins in the explorations which Westerners carried out around the world from the 15th century onwards. One of the first contexts in which the word risk emerged was to refer to uncharted waters. Risk really, however, as soon as it becomes established, which is around the 17th century, really refers to the uncharted waters of the future. The idea of risk is intimately therefore bound up with the very thrust of modernity itself. Modern Western civilization is the most future-oriented civilization in history, and its orientation towards the future has become even more pronounced in the late 20th century than it was before. You have a concept of risk when you're looking to organize the future, and I think there's a real sense in which you can say the concept of the future, which most of us operate with, and which is the concept of the future of modern civilization, is of a territory. That's why there was a fairly easy elision between exploring unknown waters and exploring future time. The Enlightenment thinkers believed the future is like a territory into which we can march. We can colonize the future by breaking with the past, by using the accumulation of knowledge to control the future so as to predict it and so as to be able to march confidently into this new territory. Very important, however, to see that the future is new territory for modernity. Closely linked, and I think really interesting, wish I had time to say more about it, but maybe you'd like to just sort of think about it after the lecture, is the connection between the rise of the idea of risk and the rise of the idea of security or safety. The two go together. And with the idea of risk, you get the idea of engineered safety, of humanly controlled, safe environments, which allow us security from hazard. The connection between the rise of the idea of risk and the idea of insurance is therefore very close. What is insurance? Well, insurance is a way of controlling future time. Risk is a way of controlling future time. Insurance is a way of trying to produce human compensation for the contingencies of life. We're also accustomed to the role of insurance, I think, whether or not it's private insurance or the collective insurance of the welfare state, because you should remember the welfare state is a collective insurance mechanism. That's what it is. It is bound up with this attempt to provide security and stability in the world, to humanize the risks of nature and society, if you like. The idea of insurance is closely bound up the idea of a controllable world, therefore. It's really interesting to look at countries in the world today which don't have developed insurance mechanisms. Several of the ex-East European countries are like this. You simply can't get insurance, or you couldn't till recently, for many of the things we just assume you can get insurance for. So if you lose your baggage, it's just tough luck. There is no way of insuring it. If you have a disaster in your house and it catches fire, it's tough luck. There's no way of insuring it. What this shows is that in most pre-modern cultures or non-modern cultures, the idea of insurance is by and large lacking, and it's replaced by an idea of fate. Insurance is the obverse of fate. Fate insists that what happens to us is given, is governed either by God or by unknown contingency. Insurance mechanisms and all modes of trying to provide safety, whether it's on an aeroplane or any other environment, are attempts to produce, therefore, a cultural difference of the first magnitude, a cultural difference which suggests that we live in a humanly controllable, engineerable world in which we can create a kind of cocoon of safety among the risks we face. Now, a good way of charting out the transition from external to manufactured risk is to consider our attitudes towards nature. Even though I think the idea of manufactured risk applies just as much to society as to nature. You can say, I think, that for many hundreds of years, human beings feared what nature can do to us. That was external risk in respect of nature. Human beings feared earthquakes, human beings feared floods, plagues, the many natural disasters which can occur. At some point, and this is quite recently, over the past 50 or so years, we started worrying much more about what we've done to nature than what nature can do to us. That point is a transition between the dominance of external risk in respect to the natural world and the dominance of manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty. If you consider an issue like declining sperm counts or global warming or BSE, none of these almost certainly, although you can never be completely certain, are natural events. We no longer live in a world of nature. We live in an important sense in a world after the end of nature. Living after the end of nature doesn't mean living in a world where there are no physical forces, of course. It means living in a world where the impact of science, technology, human involvement with the material world is so intense that there are very few aspects of the pre-given natural environment which are uninfluenced by it. Consider the rise of the green movement, consider the rise of the talk of natural goods, organic farming and so on. All these things are actually signifiers of the disappearance of nature. The particular resonance which the idea of nature has for us and the idea of the organic has to be seen in that context. It is a reaction to a world in which, in an important sense at least, we are living after the end of nature and we are the first generation to do so. Now, what are the origins, what are the causal origins of the transition from a world dominated by external uncertainty to a world dominated by manufactured uncertainty? There are four basic causal changes, I think, involved, and I'll list them fairly briefly. They form in some part the substance, however, of all these lectures. First, the impact of intensified globalization, which I discussed in the second lecture last term. Globalization refers to a complex set of forces which bite into local environments, which transform them, which transform what they do at the same time as they create new risk environments for us. Most of the more significant ecological issues are clearly the dark side, if you like, of globalization. But of course, so are also are the troubles of financial markets and the current problems of East Asia, which I mentioned. They're a result of new forms of globalization of electronic financial markets, which themselves create risk environments for which we have no particular experience previously. Second, the impact of a vast swathe of technological and scientific changes affecting not just the overall institutions of the society in which we live, but affecting crucially also our everyday lives. Modern civilization, since at least the late 18th century, has been strongly influenced by technological change and by the contribution which science makes to technological change. But for us, these processes have become speeded up, they themselves have become globalized, and they impact much more directly and immediately on our everyday lives than ever before. Key difference, I think, with earlier generations is that the impact of science and technology now has an unmediated, direct, and very intense impact on everyday life, which is speeded up, more intense, and more general across the world than it ever was before. Of course, developments in information technology are at the forefront of this, but there's a whole gamut of scientific and technological changes, all with imponderable consequences affecting our lives today. Remember, whenever you say technology, you split the human race into techno-optimists and techno-pessimists. But whatever one can say about that, technological change always carries unanticipated risks, unanticipated uncertainties. We live in a world of speeded up technological change. Coping with these is very difficult, but also very interesting, I think. Third, the disappearance of tradition and custom as key structuring elements of our lives, something which I want to say a good deal about in relation to democratization, to emotional life, and to politics. By and large, you can say that modernity was always hostile to tradition. There was always a clash between them. The whole point of modernity, as I sketched out in the beginning, was to destroy the past, not to be chained by the past. But for a long period, there was a kind of accommodation between the two, especially true in certain key areas of everyday life. In, for example, sexuality, gender relations, the family, many such things became, as it were, re-traditionalized in the 19th and early 20th centuries. What is happening to us is a new radical onslaught on tradition and custom, which means that tradition and custom, especially in Western countries, no longer have the same structuring features for our lives as they used to do. If nature is no longer a given landscape for us, tradition and custom are less and less given landscapes for us as well. Fourthly, largely as a consequence of this third point, we live in a world of increased reflexivity. A world of increased reflexivity is a world where you have to use information, you have to make sense of a diversity of claims to knowledge as a way of living a life. Whether you're talking about an individual trying to construct a life or a society or culture trying to construct a reaction to globalizing forces. Put bluntly, many aspects of our lives have to be created, invented, made up in relation to a whole diversity of knowledge claims which we face. One good way of indicating this, going back to the examples I mentioned at the beginning, is simply diet and eating. In most sectors of Western societies, there is absolutely no way in which one can any longer follow a traditional diet. The foods are simply not there anymore. We all therefore have to decide what to eat in relation to what to be, We have to decide what to eat in relation not only to how much money we've got, but in relation to claims about health, claims about the body, claims about the long-term impact of food upon our lives. There is no one, no final authority to guide us. There is no one to turn to because scientists, dietitians themselves disagree. That's what it's like living in a world of high reflexivity. The prime locus of reflexivity in our world, which the financier George Soros has also focused on, it concerns financial markets. Financial markets are instantaneous, electronic, global markets with open knowledge, where everybody knows what everybody else knows and can get that knowledge instantaneously, and where everybody is taking future decisions on the basis of anticipating future decisions that others are taking, knowing that those others are anticipating the future decisions that they are taking. That is the kind of epitome of a world of high reflexivity. But living in a world of high reflexivity infects every aspect of our day-to-day life. I'll be arguing third lecture this term. If you don't understand that, you can't understand debates about sexuality, about the body, about the future of marriage, about our emotional lives more generally. We simply do live in a much more reflexive world, which also affects politics as well. Politicians cannot treat their citizens as subjects in the way in which they used to do. A world of a high knowledge environment is simply a different world to live. By and large, most of us live in a world now where most forms of knowledge are available to anyone who has the resources to look for them. And in those fields where everyone has the same knowledge, all sorts of interesting consequences, including intrinsic uncertainty, do arise. Now, what are some of the contours of living in a world dominated by manufactured uncertainty? To close the lecture, I'd like to mention four dominant characteristics of our society which stem from this. First, our society, and I mean by this primarily modern Western society, but as globalization becomes intense, these also become global features. Modern Western society is no longer properly characterized as an industrial society. It is a society dominated increasingly by information technology. It is not, however, a postmodern society, as I mentioned earlier, I think. It is what sociologist Ulrich Beck, B-E-C-K, calls a risk society. Our society has become a risk society, and risk society is becoming a global condition of humanity at the end of the 20th century. What is a risk society? A risk society is not, to underline again, not a world which has become more risky than it used to be before. In many ways, I would say, our lives are indeed more secure, and in some respects, probably more predictable than they were in the Middle Ages. A risk society is precisely a society dominated increasingly by manufactured uncertainty, by new forms of uncertainty. A risk society is a society marked by what I would call the riskiness of risk, or the new riskiness of risk. Characteristic of all the risks I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture is that you can't chart out exactly what those risks are. And the claims to knowledge which are made are part of the very risk environments which we confront. The claims that scientists and others make about these risks are part of the very environment of knowledge which constitutes those risks in the first place. That's one of the reasons why insurance companies are struggling with these new risk environments and having to retract from insuring them. In more traditional risk environments, especially external risk environments where you can get series information which stretches over time, you can calculate risk. An insurance company can calculate the risk that you run every time you step into a car and undertake a journey of a certain distance in this country. In the case of BSE, in the case of declining sperm counts, in the case of global warming, in the case of financial markets, you do not know what the risks are. You cannot calculate them in that way. A key part of the new risk environments is that there are disputes, perhaps due to be continuous disputes, about whether the risks really exist at all. If you consider global warming, for example, most scientists agree that global warming is happening, but there is a solid core of dissidents who hold that it is not, or who hold that it is still a natural phenomenon, or who hold, believe it or not, that the world is actually getting cooler rather than hotter if you look over an appropriate period of time. Characteristic of the new risk environments is not only you can't calculate the level of risk, but there is a dispute about what the risk actually is and in some cases whether there is a risk at all. I'll come on to some consequences of that a bit later because it's very, very important. But it should lead one to be cautious about some of the things that are said about some of these risk environments in the media. For example, it's sometimes said that the BSE crisis is not a significant crisis for us because the risks involved are much lower than, for example, smoking cigarettes. You cannot say that. No one knows what BSE has stored up for us. There is no way of testing the impact of changes in the food production chain, which means essentially many foods are no longer natural foods or no longer linked in the way in which they used to be to other aspects of nature. There's no way of testing out the long-term consequences of such changes. We simply do not know what the level of risk is. No one knows whether there is a pandemic stored up from BSE or not, and we won't know, certainly with any certainty, for quite a long while whether this is so. You cannot make the same kind of risk calculations in a risk society. Notice that in a risk society, the concept of risk appears everywhere. That's because a risk society is a society which has broken away even more radically from the past than ever before, but has discovered that breaking away from the past does not create a colonized territory of the future. Almost to the contrary, the more you break with the past, the more you destroy the future. We live in a world, I think, in which the future has disappeared, in the sense in which the only way we can think about the future is in terms of alternative scenarios. Scenario thinking, that is thinking of different possible futures, replaces the idea of the future as a coherent notion for us. This is true just as much in everyday life when one thinks about one's emotional life as it is of global futures. Second, we're now in a new relationship to science and technology in a risk society. I think for many years you could say that science and technology in Western culture functioned as a sort of quasi-tradition. Most of the population left the scientists to get on with whatever it is they did, and they turned to them for sources of enlightenment when they needed to. Science was a more or less unquestioned form of expertise to which one turned. Such is no longer the case. In a world marked by the radical impact of science and technology on our lives, characterized by the uncertainty created by that impact, we now all stand in a much more dialogic relationship with science and technology, a relationship of interrogation in which we all discover the phenomenon which philosophers, including Karl Popper at the LSE, were the first to identify, that science is above all based on skepticism rather than upon the accumulation of truth. Science, Popper showed, is based upon the ability to give up claims to knowledge, the ability to give up cherished beliefs. It is based upon the possibility of giving up any belief that one holds. It is simply a form of organized, disciplined skepticism. We are all in the process of discovering this in our everyday lives. Every time you decide whether or not to eat a particular foodstuff, in relation, for example, to the latest diet book that's come out, or in relation to claims about whether or not alcohol, for example, harms you, or whether it helps you, we are all involved in that flux of scientific knowledge. Science does not stay still. Yesterday's truth can be today's received falsity and vice versa. Smoking is such an excellent example of this. 40 years ago, doctors actively recommended smoking, as a calmant. No one knew what smoking was storing up for us. Smoking is one of the biggest causes of death and disability in Western societies. Doctors recommended steaks, they recommended milk, they recommended many things that are now thought to be unhealthy for us. Which does suggest, if you want to keep ahead of the trend, you should eat what's now said to be unhealthy, because in 10 years' time, it'll all be reverse. But in this world, this is a characteristic of this kind of society, there are no final authorities. There is, in a sense, no one to turn to, but also there is, in a sense, too many people to turn to. There is no expert of all experts to guide us. Therefore, if you get ill, assuming you've got the resources anyway, because the idea of fate is very much bound up with stratification, but assuming you have the resources and the knowledge power, you have to decide, shall I consult an orthodox doctor? How many doctors shall I consult? Shall I use the NHS or not? Shall I consult a massage therapist? Shall I consult a psychotherapist? There is no one to guide you. There are even 50 varieties of psychotherapy in the world. Third, in this world, you get a new relationship, which is very important for politics and morality, between scaremongering and cover-ups. The reason for this is part of the new texture of uncertainty introduced by manufactured uncertainty. If you consider the BSE crisis, it's often said that this was simply a cock-up of the previous government. And to some degree, this is true, I think. On the other hand, it's not completely true, because you always have the issue with the onrush of science technological claims, say, when should I announce a new risk, who should I announce it to, and what evidence do I need to announce it? If you announce that risk in one kind of environment, you announce it prematurely, say, people will say, scaremongering, why are you scaring us? Why did people say, make so much fuss about global warming? You know, it's no great threat at all. On the other hand, if you hold on to what knowledge you have, you don't make that kind of announcement, you don't publish your results, and there turns out to be a risk, people will say, cover up, cover up. Why did you not tell us earlier? Why didn't you not bring this knowledge into the public domain? Now, you can see from the BSE crisis, not only that there is no clear resolution of this issue, there is no clear political mechanism for democratizing it, I think. There is no way of democratizing the impact of technology that I can see, anyway, in these sort of areas. And the impact is real. It made an enormous difference to the economy, partly destroyed the beef industry, by the simple act of making this announcement. This is another feature of living in a risk society. Finally, fourthly, all these issues bear very directly upon one of the most significant issues of the moment, the reconstruction of the welfare state. The welfare state should be understood not primarily, which it never was, I think, primarily an instrument of wealth distribution. Not primarily, even a way perhaps of simply caring for the poor. It was partly that, of course. Primarily, the welfare state was a risk management system. It's a form of collective insurance, sometimes called the social insurance state, of course, where the state tries to create a form of safety, humanly engineered safety, which takes care of the contingencies of our lives. If you see the welfare state in that sense, you can say that the key problem for the welfare state now is how do you reform welfare institutions so as to cope with a world of manufactured rather than passive risk. I'll develop this theme in the final lecture, but I'd like to suggest to you the welfare state was established against the presumption of passive risk or external risk. You get ill, the welfare state will take in care of you. You get disabled, the welfare state will step in. You get unemployed, the welfare state is there to protect you. You get divorced, the welfare state will care for you. We now live in active risk environments in which risk is a mobilizing aspect of life. It's not just a negative thing, it's a positive thing for us in many aspects of our lives. Welfare institutions no longer conform to the risk environments which we have to face. The idea of risk and the associated idea of security, therefore, as I'll try to show in the last lecture, can be a mechanism for the active and positive reconstruction of political programs and welfare systems in the society in which we live. Thanks very much. Look forward to seeing you next week.